and picturing the two of them zipping through those winding roads still makes me laugh. I love that my best friend was with me the day I became a mother. My daughter once said to me, "Mama, I've always known Jenna," and that is certainly true.
I remember walking into Angela's hospital room. Isabel was so beautiful, a little pink peanut snuggled close to Angela's chest, a sunbeam casting a gentle glow from the window. It was one of those perfectly peaceful moments you see in the movies. Then Angela asked if I'd help her to the restroom. Remember how Angela showed up for me when I broke my back in New York? Now it was my turn to lower Angela onto a toilet. Our friendship had come full circle. But things definitely changed after Angela had Isabel. It was summertime, the show was on hiatus, I didn't see Angela every day at work, and she was busy caring for her newborn. To be honest, I felt a little lost. I didn't know how to best support her, as at that point I knew nothing about babies, so I had no helpful advice to offer. She mostly talked about her nipples being sore and how tired and hungry she was. Stories about my cat and my single life felt out of place. It felt insensitive to tell her that I was sleeping in, reading books, and watching movies during the break. I didn't know how to connect.
Jenna was still in what I called the sexy life. The sexy life is that phase of your life where you decide to meet up with friends for margaritas at 10 p.m., see the midnight showing of a movie, then grab a hot dog from a late-night food truck and talk about music, art, and travel. You know that phase. It's amazing. All friendships go through challenges in some way, but nothing really challenges a friendship like one of you becoming a parent while the other is still in the sexy life. Looking back, this was probably the most disconnected time in our friendship. We were in two different worlds. It probably didn't help when, on one of my first days home from the hospital, I sent her a text that went something like this. "I just had the craziest 5 minutes of my life. I was breastfeeding Isabel, but stopped abruptly because I could tell that she had pooped and was cranky about it. So I took her to the changing table to quickly change her diaper, and my boobs were still hanging out of my nursing gown, when all of a sudden I felt this warm sensation on my legs. I looked down, and blood was running down my legs. I quickly picked up Isabel, who was naked, and rushed to the bathroom. I grabbed some towels and gently laid Isabel on top of them as I sat on the toilet, and all this blood came out. Isabel started crying, and when she did, milk started squirting out of my boobs across the bathroom and hit her in the face. She then cried more, and then I cried, and what the hell?"
I'm not going to lie, I'm still haunted by that text. Digesting that amount of information about poop and fluids and blood was more than I was ready for. I mean, after you become a mom, you text other moms about poops and bodily fluids all the time. But I didn't know that yet. This was quite a share. Also, I was hosting a poker game at my house when it came in. I was sipping whiskey and had just folded a pair of fives when my phone dinged. I read the text and my face went gray, then green. I excused myself from the table. I stared at the screen, not knowing how to respond. Is there an emoji for this? Was I supposed to text OMG, or LOL, or OMG, LOL? Was I supposed to rush over? Did she need help? The dealer yelled from the other room, "Do you want us to skip you this round?" It truly hit me how different our lives were in that moment. By the way, Angela later texted me that she was fine and that everything she was experiencing was totally normal. When work started up again, I felt more changes. Suddenly, there was a baby on Angela's lap in the hair and makeup trailer. Our ladies' lunches were over because lunchtime belonged to Isabel. Sometimes Angela would bring Isabel to my trailer where I kept a few baby toys and we would talk a little, but for the most part, lunchtime was Isabel time. I watched as Angela navigated the responsibilities of parenting with the demands of work because the work demands were the same. She was expected to keep up with our 12-hour days as if she wasn't breastfeeding, pumping, and barely sleeping.
Going back to work brought a mix of emotions. I was happy to see everyone and thankful for my job, but I really wanted to be home with my baby. Our producers went out of their way to make my transition as easy as they could. They found a trailer that had two sides connected by a small bathroom. Isabel had one side and I had the other. I set up a travel crib, some blankets, and a cozy chair where I could nurse her and eventually keep a high chair, toys, and a tiny table. Of course, her little pink push car was parked right outside. I was incredibly thankful that she could spend time with me at work. I know what a gift that was.
I learned that my best chance at serious BFF talk came when Angela was pumping. That's right, folks. We chatted while she pumped. The sound of that pump is stuck in my brain forever. Maka, maka, maka. It was the soundtrack to many of our deepest conversations.
You heard it when I did it.
Yeah, I instantly was taken back. Maka, and then if I turned it up a notch, it was like, Waco, Waco, Waco.
I remember.
One day while I was pumping, Jenna stopped me mid-sentence. Oh my goodness, your left boob makes way more milk. And I said, oh, I know, it's the better boob. But my sister says if I don't make Isabel nurse on my right boob, my left boob will get bigger and bigger, and I'll be lopsided for life. So as the weeks went on, Jenna policed me about my right boob. Don't forget, 15 minutes on that right boob. It's looking a little sad today. I think the hardest part about returning to work was the fatigue. I was up through the night feeding a newborn, and then whenever I had a break at work, I was pumping. I felt a bit out of it. A perfect example of my loopiness happened while filming Weight Loss for Season 5. It was my first week back to work, and we were having an extremely long day. We were filming in the warehouse, and as we approached the 13th hour mark, I went to get a water. Our script supervisor, Veda, offered me a Sharpie to write my name on my water bottle. As I chatted away with her, I wrote my name, and she said, "Oh, Angela, you wrote water." I wrote water on my water bottle. That's how tired I was.
At this point, Angela was on fumes, and it felt like our friendship was too. I wanted to tell Angela I missed her, but I felt selfish feeling this way. I knew what she had on her plate. Instead, I gave her space, which I later realized made her feel like I was pulling away.
For a while, Jenna continued to reach out. She invited me to all sorts of fun things, but usually at the last minute. For example, she would text me at 9 p.m. to see if I wanted to meet her for dinner. 9 p.m. dinner? I was already in bed. My life wasn't as flexible as it once was, and I had to say no. Then Jenna had an impromptu barbecue at her house, and I wasn't invited. I didn't blame her. I had turned down so many invitations. But it stung. I admit, I had definitely been hibernating with my little girl. I couldn't get enough of those little newborn moments, Isabel sleeping on my chest after a feeding, smelling her hair, and listening to her tiny noises. Of course, I was worried I was doing everything wrong as a new mom, but I also felt so at home with it all, at peace with giving my life over to this little baby. I didn't miss anything from my previous life. Still, I didn't want to lose my best friend. I decided we needed to talk. I invited Jenna over during Isabel's nap time, made us some iced tea, and we sat on my back porch. We had a huge heart-to-heart that day. I told her I was sorry if I had disappeared and that I loved her. She said she was sorry she hadn't invited me to her barbecue and explained she felt like she'd been bothering me with all her crazy invitations. Most of all, she told me she missed me too. We cried and hugged and pledged to keep talking and texting no matter what. When Isabel woke up, Jenna stayed with us for the rest of the afternoon. She watched me nurse, burp, change Isabel's clothes, and be a mom. We talked about anything and everything, and I was just so happy to be with my friend. At one point, I noticed Jenna staring at me. "What is it?" I asked. She told me I was such a natural mom, like I had always been one. She said I seemed so at ease and happy. I can't tell you how much that meant to me, because that was exactly how I felt.
That one afternoon put our friendship back on course. Sometimes that's all it takes. We didn't need to be doing anything particularly exciting at all. We just needed to connect. It felt so good to have my friend back. Next, it was my turn to be a trailblazer in our friendship. In Season 6, Pam was pregnant. I was nowhere near being pregnant in real life. This is when I became fake pregs. What does fake pregnant on a TV show look like? Fake pregnant means wardrobe gives you a weird wetsuit leotard and padded belly to wear under your clothes. Imagine a girdle with a pillow attached. The pillow size grows as your character journeys through her pregnancy. It's awful. The boy shorts of the leotard right up into your butt and lady business. Constantly. After about 30 minutes of wearing this contraption, I'd develop a thin layer of sweat underneath the bodysuit. On top of it, I was still wearing pantyhose. Why? A microphone wire. And the battery pack that goes with it. And guess what happened if I needed to pee? I had to take it all off and then put it all back on again. That process takes about 20 minutes. Can you guess how annoyed people got when I said, "I need to pee"? Also, the bigger the fake belly, the more it pressed into my bladder when I sat down, so the more I felt like I had to pee. I hated being fake pregnant. I was grouchy and complained constantly. I couldn't help it. You would too.
For the episode when Pam and Jim get married, Jenna had to wear the fake belly contraption under a wedding dress. She kept complaining that she had a wedgie from the leotard. At least once an hour, she would need to aggressively dig that wedgie out. Imagine Jenna looking radiant in a wedding dress and then digging at her undies. I laughed a lot. I didn't really take her complaining all that seriously. She told me that as the pillow size got larger, the wedgies got worse. So one day when she was complaining again, I suggested she wear different underwear under the leotard as I thought this might help. I wish you could have seen Jenna's face as she rolled her eyes and told me I absolutely didn't get it. And you know what? I didn't. But I would soon enough.
Finally, in season 8, I became pregnant in real life. At first, I didn't want to share my news with anyone at work. For many reasons, I wanted to wait until after my 20-week ultrasound to share publicly about my pregnancy. Of course, Angela knew, but no one else. It was easy enough to hide at first. I didn't experience any morning sickness. I was crazy tired all the time, but no one seemed to notice. Then, at around 14 weeks, I started to show. I needed to unzip my skirts and keep them fastened with a MacGyver-like contraption of hair ties and safety pins. Since Pam wears her blouses untucked with a baggy cardigan, I felt I could hide the bump. But around 18 weeks, I really popped. Nothing fit me anymore. I couldn't explain to wardrobe that I needed bigger sizes because they would ask for a fitting, which meant being measured with a measuring tape and trying on many different outfits. My cover would be blown. I had to take matters into my own hands. That weekend, I went to J. Crew at the mall, where I bought a pencil skirt, a button-down shirt, and a cardigan in the next size up. I actually bought two of the same outfit since wardrobe always kept duplicates. I'm a genius. I went to work on Monday with my new clothes, handed them to the costume crew, and told them emphatically, "I saw this outfit over the weekend and it felt like Pam to me. I have to wear it." Our costume designer, Alicia, stared at me confused. I mean, I had never done anything like this. She must have thought I'd gone insane, but she didn't argue, and I wore it that week. I did the same thing the following weekend.
I was so excited when Jenna told me she was pregnant. We would soon be mom BFFs together. Jenna also told me she wanted to keep her pregnancy a secret for a bit. I think I got way too into the secret keeping. I made up excuses about why I was getting extra snacks. Ridiculous things like, "Oh, I saw a baby squirrel and I think it needs some nuts and granola." And then I'd bring them to Jenna. I covered for her when she was drowsy in the hair and makeup chairs. I tried to convince everyone it might be the moon or the tide or the rotation of the planets that made her overly sleepy. In my mind, I was the ultimate wingman super spy, BFF protector, and mastermind of hiding this pregnancy. She called me from the mall when she went to get new clothes. I told her it was a brilliant plan. No one will suspect a thing.
When I hit the 20-week mark, I was excited to finally share my news. I waited until the whole gang was gathered on set, stood up at my desk, and asked for everyone's attention. Then I took a deep breath and made my announcement. "I'm pregnant!" Everyone just looked at me blankly and replied, "We know." I was shocked. Our camera operator, Matt Sohn, said, "Jenna, my wife has been pregnant twice. I look at you all day through a lens. It was totally obvious. And then you did that crazy thing with the clothes. I mean, we all thought it was really sweet how careful you were being. Congratulations. It's the best thing." And then I cried and felt silly. I was so grateful for how thoughtful everyone had been.
When she told everyone, I was just as surprised as Jenna that they already knew. Note to self, never go into any kind of espionage work. It won't go well for me.
A few days later, Greg and Paul asked me if they could write the pregnancy into the show as Jim and Pam's second baby. They thought the timing was right. I hesitated at first. What if something happened and I lost my baby? Would I still have to pretend to be pregnant as Pam? Would they write the loss into the show? Both options seemed awful. I was nervous about blurring the line between fiction and reality. On the other hand, I had seen Angela hiding her belly behind flowers and stacks of paper. It seemed easier and more fun to just let it all hang out. Lee and I talked, and we agreed to let them write my pregnancy into the show.
Once everyone knew about Jenna's pregnancy, I could take on the job I truly loved and was better suited for, BFF party planner. The crew threw her a baby shower in the Dunder Mifflin warehouse, and I hosted her friends and family one. Jenna's mom, Anne, made the baby shower invites by hand, and they were adorable. Jenna's sister, Emily, helped me figure out what games to play. The big hit was Baby Shower Price is Right. Guests held up baby items, a pack of diapers, a pacifier, rice cereal, etc., and Jenna had to guess the price.
Guys, my baby showers were amazing. I truly felt showered with love and support. I also loved being real pregnant on set. It was way, way, way better than being fake pregnant. Peter from Craft Services brought me snack trays. No one cared when I had to pee. There were no wedgies, and I was never grumpy.
When I think about Jenna being pregnant on set, the image I see is of her laughing and sitting at her desk sewing a Christmas stocking. She made both of her children Christmas stockings while she was pregnant. It was the sweetest thing. I would walk over to talk to her as she would be adding a little sparkly sequin to Santa's hat. We would talk about her food cravings and how she was sleeping, and I would give her pregnancy tips, like buy a triangle pillow to support your belly at night. I loved this new chapter of our friendship. And as a bonus, we soon had a big storyline together. The writers decided that my character would become pregnant too, so now Pam and Angela were pregnant together. Hence, big pregs, little pregs. Oh my goodness, did we have fun with that. And I suddenly had newfound respect for all Jenna had endured with the fake belly. Toward the end of Angela Martin's pregnancy, it was so cumbersome to walk in the spank-slash-fake-belly-slash-pillow-slash-leotard contraption. It pushed down on my bladder and pinched in places I didn't even know I had. Jenna had talked so much about the wedgies that I was prepared for the butt wedgie. But the front wedgie was a bit of a shock. No one deserves a wedgie in their lady business.
Talk about big pregs. My son was just shy of 10 pounds when he was born, and my belly was huge. I loved getting to share this storyline with Angela. This meant lots of scenes with my BFF. That was perfection. We had so much to talk about now. I could give her advice on how to keep the bodysuit from jamming into her crotch, and she showed me ways to reduce the swelling in my calves. I could understand the stories from her real pregnancy in a whole new way, and I was able to share my anxiety about becoming a new mom and having to juggle work and parenting. My biggest worry about becoming a mother was postpartum depression. The women in my family have a long history of postpartum depression, with several requiring medication and, in one case, hospitalization. I consulted my doctors and read everything I could on the subject. Most of the advice boiled down to three things: build a network of support, get as much sleep as possible, and don't be afraid to ask for professional help. One piece I read suggested I have my placenta turned into pills that I could take every day to level out my postpartum hormones and increase milk supply. I was sold. If I'd read that sprinkling crushed grasshoppers around my bedroom might ward off PPD, I would have done it. Through my prenatal yoga class, I found a woman who could take my placenta, dry it in her oven, and put it into pills. I understand that is a crazy sentence. I live in Los Angeles. Over half the moms I know have done this with their placentas. It's just not that strange here. Anyway, the hardest part of the process is getting your placenta to the woman in time. Someone has to get it from the hospital and transport it in a little cooler to her house within 24 hours of giving birth. For me, that person was Angela. Let me tell you, when your friend has transported your placenta in a cooler, you've crossed the best friendship finish line right there.
The day Jenna gave birth to her son, I sat in the waiting room of the hospital, anxious and excited. I watched a nature show set in Australia about the eating habits of the duck-billed platypus. Unbeknownst to me, they are carnivores. Also, why do I remember this detail from the day Jenna gave birth? Seriously, brains are weird. I zoned out, and then I prayed. I prayed that God would go before her and that she and her baby would be healthy. Finally, Jenna's husband texted me that Weston was here and that I could visit them. My heart was racing. I could barely contain my joy as I walked quickly down the hallway to see my best friend and meet her son. I wiped tears from my eyes and had the biggest smile on my face. As I read this, I'm tearing up. I was so happy for her. And he was perfect. I sat with Jenna for a bit, and we stared at his sweet little face. I even took their first family photo, Jenna and Lee and their adorable little baby boy. And then she handed me a bag with her placenta inside. I felt like we were now even for my text to her about poop, blood, and spewing breast milk.
Unlike Angela, who conveniently gave birth right before our summer hiatus, I had a due date at the end of September. Our next scheduled hiatus wouldn't be until Thanksgiving. I wondered how this would work, but I was optimistic that the powers that be would find a way to schedule creatively since we'd done it before, when other cast members needed time off to do movies. After much back and forth, I was eventually told there would be no break in filming, but I could take the legally allowed 8 weeks of unpaid disability. I hated the idea of Pam being absent from such a big chunk of the season, and missing those episodes would mean losing a third of my salary that year. So I pushed myself to go back to work after 5 weeks of leave. It felt too soon, but I hadn't been left with much of a choice. I confided in my sister Emily a lot during this time. She's a Catholic school teacher and a mom, and her job also did not offer any paid maternity leave. She had to save her sick days for 6 years before getting pregnant. That way, when she had her daughter, my niece Cece, she had logged 12 weeks of sick days. But she only took 10 weeks. She wanted to leave herself extra days in case Cece got sick or had a doctor's appointment. I think my sister assumed my acting job would be different. Turns out that was not the case. And the more women I talk to, the more I hear stories like this. The whole experience broke my heart, not just for me, but for our culture and for all women. Soapbox moment? It should not be this hard. Other countries have figured this out. We can do better. We need to do better. Needless to say, this made my first months as a new parent very stressful.
It was difficult to watch Jenna come back to work so soon. I could tell she wasn't physically or emotionally ready. On set, I tried to help her any way I could, from sharing the pump schedule that Kelly Cantley had created for me to making signs for Jenna's trailer door that said, "Baby sleeping, do not knock." I reached out to our grip department to see if they had any extra blackout curtains for her trailer windows to help Weston nap better, and I put a basket in her trailer full of those special postpartum underwear. You know, the ones that hold in your stomach but put less pressure on your healing incision, making it easier to walk around. They are huge and wonderful, and I wanted to make sure Jenna had a bunch. Sometimes I spoke up on her behalf about something in the script. For example, her first episode back, Pam was supposed to carry baby Philip into the office in a car seat. Jenna was recovering from a C-section. She couldn't carry anything that heavy. So I told Phil Shea to get Pam a stroller. The truth is, it felt like a double standard that other cast members had had their schedules accommodated for films, but Jenna was not given the same consideration after having a baby. I wish Jenna had had more time at home, and it broke my heart to see her struggle.
I honestly don't know what I would have done without Angela. Or that underwear. I've never loved underwear more. I should say, the entire cast and crew were wonderful when I returned. They rallied around and helped me make the best of a challenging situation. After becoming a mom, I reflected on those few years when Angela was a mother and I wasn't. I remember calling her and saying something to the effect of, "Thanks for hanging in there with me. I must have been so annoying during those years. I should have called you more. I should have come over more. I should have brought you food or held Isabel so you could take a bath. I had no idea how to support you, and I'm so sorry. I didn't know. Now I know." Angela just laughed and told me she'd had faith it would all work out. And it did.
Our friendship has grown so much deeper since we both became mothers. Luckily, we both mom the same way. I think that is due to our Midwestern and Southern upbringings. We are hands-on, roll-up-your-sleeves parents. We are kind, but have rules, and aren't afraid to be silly. But we also expect you to clean up your mess. Between the two of us, we now have 5 kids, Isabel, Jack, and Kate at my house, and Weston and Harper at Jenna's house. I am still moved by how graciously Jenna's family welcomed my stepsons into their lives. The weekend Josh and I and our kids set up our home together, Jenna sent us the biggest housewarming bouquet of cookies. Yes, cookies! The kids were thrilled. Over the years, our families have trick-or-treated together, welcomed one another's new family pets, had Easter brunches and Christmas get-togethers, celebrated holidays, enjoyed afternoons in the pool, and watched the Super Bowl together. I cherish the fact that Isabel was in Jenna's wedding. I am thrilled that our kids go to school together, and I get to see Jenna at school assemblies. I love that Isabel gives Harper a hug as she runs by her at recess. We've celebrated family milestones and weathered many storms together. We've listened while the other cried or worried or brainstormed about how to juggle work and family life. I know we will all share many more moments together, and my heart is full of gratitude. And Jenna, as I sit here next to you in this tiny recording booth, if by some insane act of God, because, you know, I just entered my 50s and have zero plans of having any more children, but if I ever become pregnant again, I promise not to text you about any of my bodily fluids.
Lady, I love that chapter.
It was a fun one.
I mean, more than any of them, I feel like it just sums us up.
I think we need to hug it out.
Oh, let's do it.
Let's hug it out. Come here, lady.
Guys, these noises you hear are 2 best friends hugging it out.
Get over here.
Aww.
I love you.
I love you too. Chapter 11. DeAngela Forever. Here are some phrases that have been used to describe Angela and Dwight's romance in the press and on fan sites. Strange love. Toxic. Ew. Wildest, for better or worse. Hot and awkward. Relationship goals. Weird. Gross. Sexy, but kind of disgusting. Like watching a train wreck. The greatest love story on The Office. I love them all. I meet thousands of The Office fans every year who adore the odd, geeky couple that is DeAngela. This fandom is fiercely loyal. It is a mix of people that spans cultures, ages, and degrees of quirkiness. I have had strangers at airports, at baseball games, and in the dressing room at a shopping mall show me their Dwight and Angela tattoos. I am constantly surprised at their size and placement. Imagine seeing a version of yourself on someone's calf, shoulder, wrist, or most recently on their upper thigh. Walking, breathing tributes, forever a couple, on someone's body. Then there are the couples that dress either themselves or their children as Dwight and Angela for Halloween. Thank you for tagging me every year when you post your costumes. You are my people, and I love you all. But of course, when Rain and I first met, we had no idea that there would be a DeAngela, or that we'd have 9 wonderful years to develop these characters in their relationship. Let me tell you about my first conversation with Rainn Wilson. It was during our pilot episode. I was seated with several cast members enjoying lunch when he approached us with his very pregnant wife, Holiday Reinhorn, who was visiting the set that day. When they got to the table, he gestured to her belly and said, "This is Holly, bearer of my seed." It was in that moment I realized I might have a hard time telling the difference between Rainn and Dwight. As you know, I am a big journal keeper, and the first time I wrote about Rainn was on October 18, 2005. It was during the first Halloween episode on The Office, and I was dressed like a fluffy white cat. I wrote, "Today on set, Rain said I looked like a chinchilla." It is so perfect that the first time I ever wrote about Rain, he was likening me to a rodent. As I sat down to write this chapter, I was curious about how Rain described me in his book. It is no surprise that his book, The Bassoon King, is wonderful. It is thoughtful, funny, and a delightful look into the man, the myth, the legend, who is Rain, with two N's, Wilson. On page 263 of The Bassoon King, he describes me thusly. Quote, "Angela Kinsey, who has no discernible body fat and is the size of a baby sandpiper." And then on page 264, "Truth be told, she bruises like a tiny, overly ripe albino nectarine." Never in my wildest imagination did I think I would be compared to an overly ripe albino nectarine. He's not wrong, though. I do bruise easily. In preparing for writing this chapter, I also combed through countless emails and texts that he and I have shared over the years. In them, Rain affectionately addresses me as Tiny Dancer, Little One, Darling, Friend, and Lazy Fuck. I address him as Tall Guy, Tall Friend, Fella, and Old Fuck. These emails and texts usually involve us catching up, sharing pictures of our kids, inviting each other to hang out, or sending each other links to random things on the internet we find interesting. Is he rough around the edges? Sure. Will he sometimes text you out of the blue just to say, "You suck"? Sure. But he also texts you that he loves and misses you, even if you do have, quote, feet the size of a cricket. Rain is the type of person who reaches out to tell you he's thinking of you, and his messages seem to come through just when you need them most. I have a video he texted me from New Zealand that I love. He was making a film there and so was going to miss my wedding. With a loud waterfall as a backdrop that caused him to yell to be heard, he created the funniest and sweetest message wishing me a wonderful wedding day. And because I am a digital hoarder, I still have that video, and Rain agreed to let me play it for you all. Here it is.
"Hey, Angela, it's me, Rain, and I'm sorry I couldn't be at your wedding. I'm here in New Zealand. Listen, I just wanted to wish you and, oh, who am I kidding? Angela, listen, the wedding hasn't happened yet. I love you. Be with me forever. I will kiss you with the force of 1,000 waterfalls. What do you say? Now's your chance. Lose that jackass."
He is also my only friend who wanted me to send him a photo of my disgusting-looking cyst I had removed from my abdomen. So I did. His reply, "It's beautiful." I think this level of oversharing came naturally to our friendship because of the way we first got to know each other. When I look back, it all started in Season 1, Episode 5, Basketball. It was Dwight and Angela's first on-screen interaction, and most people might not remember this brief moment, but to me it was foreshadowing. Everyone is in the bullpen working away, but Angela is rummaging through the supply shelf looking for something and getting frustrated. She turns to the room and says, "Has anyone seen the first aid kit?" Dwight holds the kit up. "How many times have I told you I'm the safety officer, not you?" Dwight drove Angela crazy from the very beginning. His love of rules and her need to be in control made them a perfect match. Of course, we didn't know then what Dwangela would become. We were only 5 episodes into our first season. So many of the show's relationships were still developing, and that was true off-screen as well. Rain and I barely knew each other. Aside from pleasantries and occasional small talk at the lunch buffet, we were basically strangers. But in Season 2, that would all change. It was a normal week on set. We were filming Episode 8, Performance Review, and things were going great. I was excited because my character had a talking head about her youth pageant days, and we had a fun scene in accounting. Maybe it's because I was so caught up in the fact that I had a talking head, which was always a big deal for the supporting cast, that I missed a clue about my character's future story arc. If you remember, Jan and Michael had hooked up outside of Chili's, and Kevin is gossiping about it. Angela sternly tells Kevin, "Don't talk about it. Office romances are nobody's business but the people involved." I didn't think much about that line until we sat down at lunch to read Episode 9, Email Surveillance. It was at that table read that I first learned Dwight and Angela were going to become a couple. There was a mixture of laughing and groaning in the room when the script read something like, "The camera pushes in on a playhouse in the backyard. There is something moving inside it. As we get closer, we see two sets of Birkenstocks, one very small pair and one very large pair, rubbing back and forth." Up to this point in the show, Rain and I hadn't done a single scene together alone. I wasn't sure what we would talk about between takes or if we would even have good chemistry. I was both nervous and excited about this new storyline and what it meant for my character. One of my biggest fears was that I would somehow blow it. Rain is such an amazing actor, and I wanted to be able to hold my own with him. Our first scene took place at the copier. Dwight says to Angela, "If you have any sensitive emails, they need to be deleted immediately." Pam overhears this and tells Jim she suspects they are a couple. For the next scene together, we have a secret conversation outside on the patio of Jim's apartment. Paul Feig told us to improvise a few lines. We are in the background of the shot, but this little moment places our characters together at the party. And importantly, there is an establishing shot of our Birkenstocks. This way, the audience recognizes whose feet belong to the Birkenstocks once those sandals start grinding. I improvised the line, "Jesus drank wine," justifying the fact that Angela was enjoying an adult beverage at Jim's party. Scandalous. Many fans have asked me what it was like in that tiny playhouse with Rain. Well, we had to look like we were having a major makeout session when in real life we were only just getting to know each other. We did not kiss in this scene, but we did have to roll around on top of each other, so yeah, it was a little weird. Also, these scenes can get tricky because everything has to time out perfectly. Jim and Michael are harmonizing Islands in the Stream when the camera pans over their shoulders and slowly zooms in on Angela and Dwight's feet. The biggest issue for Rain and me was that we couldn't hear what was happening inside Jim's apartment. We kept missing our cue, so our assistant director gave us a walkie-talkie so we would know when to start our fake makeout session. In the first take, we were lying side by side, kind of flipping our feet back and forth. Paul Feig said we looked like we were swimming a sad breaststroke and that the camera couldn't really see my feet. Rain Wilson is 6'3". I am 5'1". My feet did not protrude out of the little house the way his did, so the shot wasn't working. We had to find a way to capture both sets of feet, despite the height difference. Paul bashfully walked up to us with this note. "So, all right, how do I say this? This is a somewhat odd request, but Angela, I think we need you to lay on your back and wrap your legs around Rain. I'd love to see your feet rubbing his legs back and forth." All I could think was, "I'm not sure I'm that flexible, but okay." That didn't work either. After a few tries, we finally figured out the right position. It was as uncomfortable as it was awkward. Still on my back, I had to scooch way down Rain's torso, my face in the middle of his chest. I could barely breathe. And poor Rain was doing a plank move so that he didn't crush me. And then I realized another problem. How would I wrap my feet around his calves? Shins don't bend that way. The best I could do was this odd rubbing of the sides of his calves with my feet. You know, the super sexy side calf rub that you do while making out. In between takes, we would lie there in silence. I'm not sure either of us knew what to say. It was an odd way to spend time with someone you don't know that well. But as the night wore on, I began to relax and became my chatty self. I started peppering Rain with questions about his life, and we launched into deep conversation. We talked about our childhoods, our spiritual beliefs, and what we hoped for in our lives. In between the big stuff, we also covered the random things, like places we had traveled to, that year's football season, and our crazy rescue pets. And then I taught him some phrases in Indonesian. In particular, "I'm cold," saya dingin, because despite wearing a huge winter coat, I was freezing, and that little playhouse had no heater. Rain let me borrow his scarf, asked for hand warmers for me, and made sure the assistant director gave me bathroom breaks. I would learn that that is just the type of guy he is. He looks out for the people he cares about. It was such a strange juxtaposition, doing this silly scene and having a heart-to-heart at the same time. When we heard, "Action!" on our walkie-talkie, I would quickly give him his scarf back, scooch down to his midriff, he would roll over on top of me and do his plank move, and then I would awkwardly wrap my ankles around his legs and rub my Birkenstocks on his calves. We did this every take, and there were many. Somewhere in this face-to-chest, suffocating plank straddle foot-rubbing craziness, we became friends. Rain would show up for me many times over the course of the show, but one moment in particular stands out. It was season 3, A Benihana Christmas, and the writers created a storyline that involved me needing to sing karaoke. Here's the thing. I hate singing in front of people. It is the only time I get stage fright. It doesn't really make sense because I love performing in front of people. I can do the zaniest sketch comedy, prattle away on talk shows, perform improv, and speak to huge crowds. But singing in front of anyone besides my family gives me major anxiety. Angela Martin was supposed to sing The Little Drummer Boy in front of the bullpen, and I panicked. I went to Harold Ramis, our director that week, and told him I didn't think I could sing. He smiled, patted me on the back, and simply said, "But you will." I started to spiral. I confided in Rain. I think I said something really eloquent like, "Rain, I'm gonna shit myself." He told me to sing the song as Angela Martin and not Angela Kinsey. This felt like good actor advice, and I gave it a go. We did the first take, and I actually got through it, but barely. My voice wavered and my hand shook. In the second take, I somehow lost the beat. How is that even possible? It's The Little Drummer Boy, not the Star-Spangled Banner. By the third take, I couldn't find the tune at all and clutched my hands tight in front of my chest so no one could see how much I was trembling. It was then that my friend Rain decided to step in to help. I started the song again, and much to my amazement and gratitude, my big, tall scene partner dropped to one knee and held out the microphone for me and came in with a pa-rum-pa-pa-pum, pa-rum-pa-pa-pum, pa-rum-pa-pa-pum. Rain helped me find the beat. Plus, I was no longer alone. If you watch that scene, you will see a huge smile come across my face. That is not Angela Martin smiling at Dwight Schrute. That is Angela Kinsey smiling at Rain Wilson for saving her butt. He saw me struggling and improvised that moment. To this day when I hear that song, I think of him and smile. On the other extreme, there was the time he nearly made me vomit, and not fake cold soup vomit. We were filming Goodbye Toby in season 4. Dwight and Angela are sneaking around behind Andy's back when Phyllis catches them in the act. It was described in the script something like this. Spy shot. An exhausted Phyllis comes out of the elevator with a box of party supplies. As she gets closer to her desk, she hears rustling. It's coming from behind the file cabinet. She looks and sees a tiny blonde head peeking out. Phyllis and Angela see each other. Phyllis then sees Dwight. Phyllis gasps. As we began to rehearse the scene, we realized we had a problem. I was 8 months pregnant, and not fake pregs. How would we hide my very big pregnant belly? Once again, poor Paul Feig had to brainstorm awkward make-out positions for Rain and me. We tried lying on the floor behind the copier, a standing pose by the file cabinets, crouching behind reception, and finally settled on me sitting on Angela's desk with Rain standing in front of me, blocking my belly with his body. We really wanted the image of Dwight and Angela in the throes of passion to be shocking to both Phyllis and the audience. Because of my belly, there couldn't be much of my body shown in the shot, so Paul had the idea for Angela to have her hair down, giving her that tousled look, and for Dwight to be shirtless. To sell this sexy moment and cover the belly, Rain had to lean way over to kiss me. By this time, we were old friends, and the scene would not have been much of an issue except for the fact that right before the take, Rain ate a tuna fish sandwich. Let me repeat that. Tuna fish. Kissing someone who has just eaten tuna fish is not pleasant for anyone, but for a pregnant woman, it crosses into the vomit zone. At this point in my pregnancy, I could have smelled that tuna fish sandwich if he had been eating it in New York, let alone a few feet away. I literally started to gag. After the first take, I forced him to eat a handful of mints. Some of the funniest and most moving moments of my life as an actor have happened with Rain. I didn't think we were going to get through the moment in Beach Games when Dwight whispers, "Sabotage." And I respond, "Did you say sandwich?" And we couldn't stop laughing as he lists Dwight's ridiculous directions to get to the beet farm in The Surplus Season 5, or when I list off all the steps required to take care of Sprinkles. That scene was so special to me that I asked the props department if I could keep the notepad of Sprinkles' medical treatments. Once when Rain and I were featured in Entertainment Weekly magazine, they asked if we could also do an online interview. You can still find it on YouTube. For this, Rain made up a song calling me a cousin fucker as a nod to my Southern family. I then made fun of his constant demands for Diet Cokes and called him a colossal asshole. You should have seen the reporter's face. Most of our interviews ended with either fits of laughter or me whacking Rain as if I'd lost all patience. I know part of me will always be emotionally tethered to Rain. We journeyed through a decade of life together. So in Season 9, when Dwight and Angela finally reunite, I felt so happy. I deeply cared for them as a couple. I had been rooting for them for so long. And in the last act of the episode, AARM, they finally get back together. Dwight realizes he cannot live without Angela, and he decides to pour his heart out to her. When we started to film the proposal scene, Dwight tells Angela he loves her, and Rain as Dwight tears up. I also began to tear up. We could feel the weight of the moment for our characters. I looked over to our crew on the side of the road, and they were tearing up. We were all so invested in this couple's happily ever after ending. And I know that everyone always talks about that epic Jim and Pam proposal scene, and it is truly beautiful. But did it start with a car chase? Did Pam yell, "What the fuck is wrong with you?" Did Jim start his speech with, "Shut up, woman"? Did he promise to love her and raise 100 of her lover's children? Was his love expressed loudly through a bullhorn? Did he buy the ring in a jewelry store, or was it taken out of a family member's butt? I mean, come on. This is an epic proposal. Dwight and Angela had many amazing moments on The Office. They fell in love. They gave each other fantastic gifts of bobbleheads and house keys. They created pet names for each other: Monkey, Possum, Half Pint, and Dee. They secretly slow danced outside of Phyllis and Bob Vance's wedding and mastered talking in code with "No Cookie." They probably messed around in the Dunder Mifflin office more than any other couple. In the warehouse, the break room, the kitchen, and at Angela's desk, to name just a few of the locations. They kissed with the force of 1,000 waterfalls and bonded over their mutual hatred of jazz. And yes, they fought, made up, were involved in the mercy killing of a cat, R.I.P. Sprinkles, broke up, dated, got engaged to other people, cheated on those people with each other, got fake married in a barn, but actually real married except only one of them knew, broke up again, decided to procreate, and have a contract about said procreation, bathed an elderly aunt together, conspired to have a coworker killed / badly maimed, had a baby, and survived a scandalous divorce. But through it all, their love could not be denied. They were meant to be together. It's a beautiful love story, really. A strange, toxic, awkward, weird, gross love story that will stand the test of time and live forever in people's hearts and on their upper thighs. Since The Office ended, our lives have taken us in different directions. I don't get to see my tall friend as often as I would like, but I am thankful that we stay in touch. We text and talk regularly, meet for lunch dates and dinners, participate in events together, and Rain has even been known to drop by my house. He is a huge hit with my children, who he calls idiots, much to their delight. We continue to show up for each other, and thanks to The Office, I have a friend for life. And Rain, if you are listening to this, you probably have horrible coffee breath and need a mint. Love, Angela.
Chapter 12. Death Bus.
Remember earlier in the book when we told you there were two episodes of The Office that involved travel that nearly ended in disaster? The first one was on a boat for Booze Cruise in Season 2, and the other was on a bus in Season 9. Well, it's time for the other half of that story, folks. You might know this episode as Work Bus, but the cast of The Office know it as Death Bus. If you thought losing half the cast at sea in the middle of the night during booze cruise was crazy, wait until you hear about this one.
Before we head out on the open road, see what I did there? We need to bring you all up to speed. One more. So buckle in, last one, I promise, because a lot happened at Dunder Mifflin before the bus ever left that parking lot. Okay, done with driving puns. At this point in the series, the show had gone through some noteworthy transitions. Around season 5, the tone of The Office changed a bit. Gone were the days of 27 seconds of silence and long, lingering shots of random office work. With Paul Lieberstein and Jen Salata as showrunners, we seemed to take on a faster, more comedic pace. Our 5th was a fun season that resulted in some of my favorite episodes of the series, like The Duel and Lecture Circuit. In our earlier seasons, we had resisted casting big-name guest stars on the show. Greg feared it would destroy the authenticity of our little paper company documentary to have, let's say, Deborah Messing walk in as a new client. But as the show went on and our cast members became household names themselves, we abandoned this rule and started casting folks like Idris Elba, Amy Ryan, and Timothy Oliphant in recurring roles. Then, in season 6, we added Kathy Bates to the cast as Jolene Bennett, CEO of Sabre, the company that acquired Little Dunder Mifflin. Of all our marquee name guests, I never got used to doing scenes with Kathy Bates. From the moment I saw her, I was in awe. I'd been a fan forever. At one point, my hair colorist had told me he had also once colored Kathy Bates' hair, and I about died thinking I was one degree of separation from an acting legend. And now, here I was, about to share the screen with her. As she walked through the door of our first table read, the whole space took on a different vibe, one of importance and class, like in the Harry Potter movies when Dumbledore enters a room. Kathy Bates walked slowly to her chair, sat, took a sip of water, opened her script, and then, the best thing ever, she took out a delicate golden folded fan. Apparently she was hot. As we read the script, she would occasionally fan herself with her golden fan, all the while delivering her lines with expert precision. I looked at her and thought, I hope that one day I earn the right to fan myself with a golden fan at a table read. This woman is my life goals.
I had 2 moments with Kathy Bates I'll never forget. I was always freezing on set, so I kept a small heater under my desk to keep me warm. Phyllis, Kate, and Jenna also had little heaters. Our set was super cold. The accounting department had a scene with Kathy, and as she walked up to my desk during the camera rehearsal, she said something to the effect of, "My God, it's hot over here. It's like the Sahara." I distinctly remember her referring to my desk as the Sahara. I was mortified, so I quickly slid my foot under my desk and kicked the off button on the heater. My other memory of Kathy Bates, and it's how I always want to think of her, was in hair and makeup. We were sitting side by side one morning and began talking about our love of road trips. Turns out, Kathy is a big road tripper. She owns an RV and told me about this wonderful road trip she took and places where she could park her RV. I felt like this was our bonding moment and hopefully made up for my Sahara desk. Kathy, if you're listening to this, Jenna and I would like to throw something out there. Road trip. The 3 of us.
All with golden fans. We also added Zach Woods in season 6 as Joe Bennett's minion Gabe Lewis. He was a wonderful addition to the cast and a brilliant improviser. He also became one of our most treasured guests at Angela's real-life Yankee swap parties. Things were clicking along. Pam got married and delivered her daughter. It was a fun year. Then, in season 7, Steve Carell's contract was up, and he told us he was leaving the show. We were devastated to see him go, but not surprised. We knew those years as our leader, combined with doing multiple movie roles, had meant missing out on many family events. By leaving the show, he would have much more time to do his favorite thing, be a dad. To bridge his departure, we welcomed Will Ferrell as new Scranton branch manager, D'Angelo Vickers. Having Will on set was a treat. If anyone could challenge Steve for nicest guy and best improviser, it was Will. And Amy Ryan returned as Michael was reunited with his true love, Holly. As we did our final episodes with Steve, it was difficult to contain our sadness at losing our friend and our trusted number one. We cried a lot. The worst was the day we filmed his goodbye song. People often ask if Steve knew we were going to sing to him because the emotion on his face is so genuine. We'd all been given the lyrics and practiced the song in secret. Steve told me that as he was being led into the conference room, he knew something was up, but he did not know we were going to sing, and the whole thing was very moving. The first time we tried to film the scene, no one could get through it. You can hear Ed Helms' voice breaking before the song even begins when he says, "We want to thank you for everything."
During Steve's last week on set, I was doing some filming for Adventures with Angela for NBC.com. I'd film behind-the-scenes moments and answer fan questions. A lot of fans wrote in that week wanting me to interview Steve about his time on The Office. Steve agreed, and I walked over to his trailer one day during lunch to chat. Before we could get to the fan questions, I started to cry. I had to compose myself and start again. During the interview, Steve shared that leaving the show was also emotional for him. He said that when he'd spoken with his wife Nancy about how difficult it would be to say goodbye, she reminded him that while the role of Michael Scott had been such a big part of his career and was certainly hard to leave behind, it was the friendships on set that were always the most important to him. Those he would take with him. We might have been losing Michael Scott and his ridiculous antics, but we would never lose our friend Steve. This interview is still on YouTube, and it made me cry to watch it even after all these years.
When season 8 began, we enlisted James Spader as new CEO Robert California. Many critics argue that season 8 was clunky, as it was clear we were trying to figure out the show without Steve. And I won't argue. But working with James Spader was a highlight of my career. As a child of the 80s, I had seen almost every single one of James Spader's movies, and of course, I was a fan. When the producers told us he'd be coming on board to play our new boss, I was beyond excited to work with him. It took me several weeks before I had the courage to bring up his filmography in the hair and makeup trailer. We had all wanted to do this, and one day I finally worked up the courage. I'm so glad I did. He told us everything about every movie I'd ever watched growing up. Pretty in Pink, Less Than Zero, Sex, Lies, and Videotape, Bad Influence. I won't include any of our conversations here, as they are mostly R-rated. But guys, it was like attending a masterclass in 1980s Hollywood gossip. I think my favorite thing about James was his love of rehearsal. In the early seasons of The Office, we used to do multiple rehearsals before shooting a scene. We'd form huddles with the writers and producers and talk at great length about our characters' motivations. But by season 8, we all knew our characters so well, we felt like we didn't need those lengthy rehearsals and discussions anymore. Enter James Spader. For his first scene, the director said, "Okay, James, you enter the bullpen here and land about here, talk with the group, and we will end with you over by reception." James asked if we could do a rehearsal. We explained that was the rehearsal, a quick rundown of our movements. Well, that's not what James Spader meant by rehearsal. Not at all. He tried different takes on his lines. He tried different blocking. The theater nerd in me was delighted. I wanted to jump up and hug him. I was struck by how this acting legend was still devoted to meticulously planning every scene. This guy does not phone it in, folks. This became the new normal for scenes with James. We made space in the schedule to rehearse. Most people tolerated it, but I loved it.
Like Jenna and every other person on our set who grew up in the 80s, we were all pinching ourselves when we heard that James Spader was joining The Office. One morning, I walked into the hair and makeup trailer, and James frickin' Spader was seated next to me. I mean, Pretty in Pink played on repeat on my giant Betamax back in the day. You know what I'm talking about. Steph, sitting right there. OMG. I played it cool, you guys, but it was not easy. For weeks, we were seated side by side in hair and makeup. We would say our hellos. James Spader was always friendly and professional. He usually reclined and closed his eyes as his makeup was applied. James Spader was so relaxed. James Spader is a pro. I, on the other hand, would chat away with my makeup artist, Kenneth Paul, about my life and everything else. I was newly single, and one morning I was telling KP how I let my daughter sleep with me in my bed. She was still little, and since it was just the two of us, I didn't see the harm. James Spader sprang forward as if awakened from a deep slumber. He turned to me with great force and said, "Angela, if you ever want a man in that bed, you must get your child to sleep on her own." I was so stunned, I think I squealed. From that day on, we would have amazing conversations in hair and makeup. I remember the day his adorable young son visited. James shared with me that his in-laws were in town. I told him that my mom and dad and sister were also about to visit, and I was worried about where everyone would sleep. He shared with me his strategy for having guests. He makes sure that the guest room is uncomfortable and placed in a location of the house difficult to get to and far away from the bathroom. This delighted him. His theory was if guests are uncomfortable, they won't wear out their welcome. I couldn't help but laugh.
We also added Catherine Tate to the mix as special projects manager Nellie Bertram. Her sketch comedy television show on the BBC, The Catherine Tate Show, is incredible. If you haven't seen it, give it a watch. The writers had seen her show and asked her to relocate from London to Los Angeles to play the role of Nellie. My favorite story about working with Catherine is from shooting the episode Andy's Ancestry in Season 9 when Pam has to teach Nellie to drive. Because Catherine Tate couldn't drive. When she came to America to join us on the show, they had to hire a driver to bring her to and from set. But when we shot the episode, they put her behind the wheel. So when you watch the scenes, just know that all the fear on my face is real. At one point, Catherine actually drove on the wrong side of the road while we were filming, and not on purpose. If memory serves, Catherine actually ran the car into some things. They made her eat a salad in the scene while trying to drive. I honestly think I might have peed my pants a little. From fear. And from laughing.
That brings us to Season 9, our farewell season. James Spader left the show. We added two more new cast members, Clark Duke and Jake Lacey, playing Clark Green and Pete Miller, respectively. Andy Bernard moved into the position of Scranton branch manager, and Greg Daniels returned as our showrunner. One of the first orders of business was to load 15 actors onto a traveling work bus and embark on a journey of doom. Workbus was written by executive producer Brent Forrester and directed by Bryan Cranston. We want you to know that we see the irony that Bryan Cranston, a.k.a. Walter White Sr., or Heisenberg, as he was known in crystal methamphetamine circles, was an accessory to almost murdering the entire cast of The Office. I assure you, this is pure coincidence. It was also the source of great humor that when Bryan finally got a week off from filming Breaking Bad, a television show that takes place primarily in an old RV in the desert with the main characters constantly dodging death, he then spent his vacation directing an episode of a show that normally takes place in an office with the main characters trying to survive boring conference room meetings, but for that week was set on a bus in the middle of nowhere. He went from an RV to a bus. It was almost like he brought it on himself. The plot went this way. In the hopes of getting some free vacation days, Jim tricks Dwight, who now owns the building that houses Dunder Mifflin, into thinking that the office is unsafe and in need of repairs. Dwight agrees, but instead of sending everyone home, he calls Jim's bluff and presents the employees with a mobile office to use while the repairs are being made. The majority of the episode occurs on the bus that Dwight has transformed into a mobile workplace. Of course, this was a very Dwight move.
Imagine a small airport shuttle filled with desks, chairs, lamps, printers, a water cooler, a microwave, a giant screen TV, a coffee maker, 14 actors, and 4 crew members. What could go wrong? Who could have predicted that Ellie Kemper would pee her pants or that the entire cast would almost be killed? Twice. Things started off fine, because the first scenes on the bus were shot in the Dunder Mifflin parking lot, not moving and close to home. Sure, the bus was hot and crowded, but we could unload between takes, use the restroom, eat snacks, and stretch. The bus was a novelty, sort of fun. John Krasinski and Bryan Cranston were doing comedy bits. We were all laughing.
In the story, Jim convinces Andy that since they are stuck on this work bus, he should take everyone to get pie at the best place in town, Laverne's Pies, Tires Fixed also. Andy agrees, and so it was time to roll. The producers decided the best use of our time was to transport the actors from our home base to our rural pie stand location on the actual work bus. We had scenes that needed to happen on a moving bus, and the idea was that we could grab little bits of the script along the way. A shot of Dwight driving, a shot of people trying to work. This all sounded fairly easy, but it was a very hot day, and whenever we started filming, the air conditioning on the bus had to be turned off because it was too noisy. We were basically in a moving hot tin can with no air. I thought Bryan and Creed were going to melt. Oscar looked dead inside. Plus, it was a very curvy road. Jenna was getting a little carsick, even though she had a forward-facing chair. At that point, the heat and the nausea seemed like our worst obstacles.
Once we made it to the country road, we were able to disembark and get some fresh air. Sweet air. We were all given little battery-operated fans and water. We loaded back onto the bus, refreshed, and started into the main action of our first scene. For this, John Krasinski's character Jim does a chant called Shibuya Roll Call. It also appeared in Spike Lee's film Get on the Bus, and later in the cheerleading movie Bring It On, All or Nothing.
For days, this chant lived in my head. As I went to sleep at night, all I could hear was, "My name is Kevin. That is my name. They call me Kevin, 'cause that's my name." Each cast member was so funny, trying earnestly to sing their introduction, especially Phyllis. We would dissolve into laughter each time. I'm sure this was extremely frustrating to our crew, who were trapped on a hot moving bus full of actors who couldn't get their takes because they kept breaking. Only a portion of what we shot ended up in the actual episode. So go to the deleted scenes on the DVD for more fun moments. Trust me, it's good stuff. It was during one of these laughing fits that Ellie peed her pants. That's right, folks. She laughed so hard, she peed her pants. Then, like only Ellie Kemper can, she adorably screamed, "Oh my God, you guys, I just peed my pants!" Cue even more laughter.
To be fair to Ellie, it wasn't a huge pee. More like a large tinkle. But it was enough that she needed a change of wardrobe. We put some prop work papers down on her chair to try to cover the wet spot for her, while she used some napkins from the prop coffee station to dry her skirt. That's all we had on the bus. Fake work papers and a few napkins. And we could not stop laughing. Our camera operators then radioed to the producers in the follow van to explain what had happened. Poor Bryan Cranston. I bet he couldn't wait to go back to the New Mexico desert at that point. His actors were losing it and peeing themselves, and we'd just gotten started.
We should probably explain about the van that was following us that day. When you are filming in a moving vehicle, there's usually a van behind you with the directors, producers, and hair and makeup and wardrobe team. It's creatively called the follow van. The folks in the follow van have a monitor with a live stream from the camera in the vehicle, and the actors, directors, and producers communicate on walkie-talkies. It's very handy in case of wardrobe malfunctions and peeing.
Eventually, our follow van directed us to a remote park with a walking trail and public restrooms. The bus pulled over and out poured the cast of The Office. The wardrobe department appeared with a new set of clothes for Ellie. We all laughed and laughed in the park as some very confused hikers passed by. We were joking this would go down as the episode when Ellie peed her pants. Little did we know that would not be the most memorable part of the day, not by a long shot. We loaded back onto the bus. The next scene involved Dwight driving like a maniac. For this, the bus was hooked up to a rig that pulled us along as Rain pretended to drive. The idea was that as Rain would pretend to swerve, the assistant director would yell, "Right!" and we'd fling ourselves to the right. Then Rain would swerve the other way, the assistant director would yell, "Left!" and we'd all lunge left. We tried this. The bus stopped. There was a discussion. I guess our flailing looked fake, and it was clear the bus was not swerving at all. Rain Wilson was told to get off the bus. The bus was then detached from the rig, and a stunt driver climbed on board. There were no stunt actors, however. We stayed on and were told to keep doing what we'd been doing, and off we went.
We were all bouncing down the road, blissfully unaware of what was about to happen. We were saying our lines and everything was going smoothly when all of a sudden we heard the assistant director yell, "Swerve!" The stunt driver swerved hard. I mean, he cranked that wheel like coal trickle in Days of Thunder. As a result, the entire cast and contents of the bus went flying into the side of the party bus. What no one had considered when they told the stunt driver to swerve as hard as he could without flipping the bus over was that none of our office furniture, props, or set decorations were securely tied down. Let me remind you what was on the bus. Desks, lamps, laptops, printers, a 5-gallon water dispenser full of water, a coffee station complete with a microwave, coffee pot, coffee mugs, paper, lots of paper, pens, calculators, notepads, mini fans, oh, and our rolling desk chairs. One hard stunt driver swerved to the right, and everything and everyone went flying. Everything.
When the bus came to a stop, I was pinned against the side of the bus. Leslie was on top of me. Creed, John, lamps, laptops, chairs were all on top of Phyllis. You could have heard a pin drop.
We were all smushed up against the side of the bus. Ellie's chair crashed into Jake's. Jake's crashed into mine, and I was shoved against the glass window. Papers were everywhere. I caught our desk lamp as it slid into my lap. A few people fell on the bus floor, and we could barely see them because so many things had fallen on top of them.
We all helped one another crawl out of the office furniture pile, off the bus, and onto the side of the road. Someone gave Phyllis ice for her ankle. There was a long conversation among the crew. Our camera operators were pretty frustrated. They, too, experienced the